After experiencing the transformative power of a regular meditation practice, it's natural to feel inspired to share this gift and guide others on their own journey of discovery through meditation. Join Buddhist teacher David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell, comedian and creator of the Netflix animated series The Midnight Gospel, for a free online event on Tuesday, May 7th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. They'll discuss the profound practices of mindfulness in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell.
Japanese art is really affected by Zen historically. Mm. There's something called Rakupari, R-A-K-U, that really embodies that. And Rakupari, you bake in the cracks, you bake in the overflows, you bake in the irregularities, and those cups, those teacups are really valued because each is idiosyncratic, each is individual, and yet each is authentic because it's open to its cracks, it's open to its irregularities.
Hey everyone, it's Raghu and I am back with Mind Rolling on the Be Here Now Network, and delighted to have with me Tim Burkett. And Tim has a new book out. Tim is in the Zen community basically for your whole life. Welcome, Tim.
Thank you, Raghu. Thank you.
And yes, I was saying I was really attracted by the title of the book when I got a hold of it. Enlightenment is an accident. Which is very, you know, provocative and hopeful at the same time. Maybe I could have that accident. But before we even get further into that, I always like to hear what it was that got you to the place, even in your youth, where you realized, wait a minute, this stuff they're handing me regarding the societal norms and the goals of those around me and the mental chatter and the me too land is not potentially what reality is all about. Yeah, so what were the things that just made...
Would you like me to give you a 2-minute answer or an 8-minute answer?
Whatever seems to flow, it'll be good.
All right. Well, I was sophomore or junior at Stanford University. I was majoring in psychology. I had no background in religion or spirituality. And this is many, many years ago, 1963, 64. And I took a course from Walter Mischel in abnormal psychology. And I decided to write my term paper on lysergic acid, because in 1963-64 there was just an initial real interest in that in academic circles, and so I did all my research for the paper.
I'm sure you bumped into, of course, those two guys, right, at that
Which
time
guys?
Leary and Alpert.
Yeah, less later. So I researched the paper, and there was no acid available at Stanford that I knew of in 1963 or 64. Maybe I was hanging out with the wrong people.
You were the wrong crowd.
As I was researching the paper, I began reading about world mysticism and the fact that there was a deep peace where we feel connected with all life, but not beneath our chattering mind. I couldn't believe it, but my first book was The Teachings of the Mystics, and by Walter T. Stace, and he just pointed out in all these different traditions And so I became kind of entranced by that. So entranced that I quit. I did finish the abnormal psych paper, but basically I quit going to my classes at Stanford mostly, and just pored over this book again and again and again, reading about Taoism, Advaita Vedanta, Jesus's peace that passes understanding. And I became transfixed, and I didn't know how to meditate, but I meditated without knowing it. Then I had a huge enlightenment experience when I just had a huge one where Tim completely died, and
no lysergic,
nothing.
Zero. You hadn't taken it. You had not had a psychedelic.
I'd never taken it. And the experience just, you know, set the course of my whole life. Then I started coming back to Tim and his worries about getting back to Stanford and everything he had incompletes on the train coming back from Utah, where I'd been skiing with my friends. As he came in, by the time I got back to Stanford, he had taken over again.
He did,
That little narrator, that narrator who's so kind of bossy, had taken over. And so I thought, well, this is what I want to do in my life. Mm-hmm. I want to ground myself in this wonderful peace. You know, on the train, I didn't know. I was not even raised a Christian or a Jew, but my intern minister liked Jesus's teaching, and I repeated for myself over and over on the train without knowing going out there before I had the experience, the peace that passes understanding. I just repeated it over and over, and then I got to see my friends in Utah, everything fell apart, and Tim just died completely. So anyway, this is a memory, and I'm coming back, and I want it. So I think, well, where do I find this? And I'd read in my book that Zen was the simplest and least ordained way, or at least decorative way, less ritual, less, not little did I know that I was wrong. But anyway, that's what I thought.
I was going to say.
Yeah. Straightforward, you know. And so then I went up to San Francisco, and I looked in the San Francisco phone book. This is 1964, and I went to Chinatown. I thought, oh, Chinese? Oh, that will be good. Chinese, there must be Chinese. No one in Chinese that had been in Chinatown had ever heard of Zen. I didn't know that Zen was a translation of the word Chan, but I don't know if it would have helped. They didn't know. But then somebody told me, look in a phone book, and I looked in a phone book, and I found the Zen bar and the Zen center. And I thought, well, I'm already know how to drink, you know, way more than I need to. So I'll go to the Zen center. And this is 1964, before the counterculture had really
taken off.
And I went over to Sokoji Temple in Japantown, knocked on the door, and this little man named Shinryo Suzuki came down and greeted me, and that was the beginning. And that's basically, I'm 20 years old then, and I'm 80 years old now.
You are. Oh, my God. You are fantastic, Tim. You look so great. For everybody out there, by the way, Tim is referring to a teacher that is one of the icons of the unraveling of our, shall we say, self-involved psychology and life that led us to a place of, wow, there can be something else. There is another reality. Suzuki Roshi is very famous, everybody. And definitely we will put his books in the show notes so people can get directed. But so you met him. I'd just love to hear
He answered the door, because it was unknown then. I mean, you know, there was just a little group. So he answered the door himself.
Really? And?
And he invited me upstairs. I sat with him. I told him about my wonderful experience. And I watched him. And he said, "That is good, but it is not Zen." And then he took me into the meditation hall and told me to sit on a cushion and suggested I come sit with him whenever I could, if I wasn't at Stanford, every morning. And I was a little bit annoyed that he said that wasn't Zen. I mean, but I think he intuited pretty fast that I was caught on this experience that I'd had. You know, when even a beautiful enlightenment experience, if we're caught on it, we're caught. It's just like being caught on anything.
Yeah.
And that was the problem, not with Richard Alpert so much, but with Timothy Leary, as I experienced them back then.
Uh-huh. Did you meet them back then?
Not personally, but I went to their talks.
Oh, you did?
Yeah. And Richard Alpert talked at Stanford. I heard him talk. I heard Richard Alpert talk at Stanford in 65, 66. I don't know when it was. And then I heard him again, and that was when he was still Richard Alpert.
Mm.
And he was very entertaining.
Yeah, even back really then. Yeah.
Good speaker. But he seemed not to have this sort of humility and naturalness that Suzuki did. This is in 1965 or 66. Then I heard him speak. He came here to Minneapolis, 82, 83. He was Ram Dass by then. He was better, but it wasn't until he had his stroke, after his stroke, that I heard him, that I thought, oh, his ego has really fallen away. It's no longer predominant. He's living within the background and not just the foreground.
Mm. That's amazing you say that, actually. Not amazing. It's certainly real. But many of us, you know, and I have known him since, late 60s and so on.
Oh, you've known him since the late 60s, too.
Yeah. Yeah. And then all through the decades, off and on, you know, sometimes I was more involved with him than others, depending on what I was doing, what he was doing. But we, you know, the power of his siddhi, they call it in India, you know, the advanced way he could open up the doors to Eastern mysticism, to the West, in a way, because he was a psychologist, because he had done all of these, you know, really committed to psychedelics and psychedelic insight. Because of all of that, he really could point the way to the way. But you're right, Tim, that it was after he had his stroke, and particularly in the last 15 or so years of his life, which he spent in Maui, and then this organization came up around him to help support his work and his life, for that matter, because he couldn't travel anymore. And, you know, couldn't earn a living that way. But fortunately, the internet blew up, of course, at that time. And it was then that we well noticed he was being in the way rather than pointing to the way. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, of course, many people noticed that, including you. Yeah. So pretty amazing journey. And, I used to say to him, because, you know, he had pain all, and he was dealing with a lot of, you know, untoward stuff, health stuff, being half paralyzed in a chair.
After the stroke.
Yeah, 23 years in a chair was like a miracle. Nobody ever, after a stroke, for someone to live that long was, shall we say, at least highly unusual. So he was dealing with a lot of stuff. And, you know, I used to speak to him, you know, not quite on a daily basis, but and see him in Maui a lot. And, you know, he just was not copping into poor me and, oh, my God, the pain, none of that. you know, and I used to say to him, you know, if I have 10% of the indefatigability that you represent when I'm going through, you know, elderly state, shall we say, I would be very happy. Yeah, no, he was pretty amazing those last years in Maui.
You had good fortune just like me. You got to really hang out with him in crucial years for you.
Yeah. Well, the real, shall we say, quote unquote good fortune, we can, you know, discuss what that really means, mm-hmm. was meeting Neem Karoli Baba.
Oh yes, you went to India.
Yeah. I went to India when he went back the second time. Uh-huh. I went back and I met him over there alongside of, you know, a number of other Westerners, some of them quite well known as teachers in the West right now, from Krishna Das and people like uh-huh. him. And uh-huh. Just as Suzuki Roshi opened that door, literally, and you walked in, I had the same thing happen. Ram Das opened that door to a being that I had no idea that this really existed. I believed Ram Das and everything he was saying, but I had no idea that, you know, you get into the presence as you did with Suzuki Roshi, and then you understand that there is a place that us humans can get to, which is enlightenment is a tough word. And I wanted to sort of parse that with you a little bit. Just talk about the idea behind the book, really.
The idea behind the book, and you already know this, Raghu, is that we can't get enlightened. We have to die to everything. Even the idea that we have to die, and I don't mean literal death physically, but I do mean psycho-spiritual death. And how can we, and that's an accident, because we actually, that's the only way it happens, but we can make ourselves accident prone. And that's what I help my students do. That's what I did for years. We can do that through, I have 5 different chapters on ways to make ourselves accident prone. And once we are accident prone, then it's possible for us to fall awake. We completely let go of everything, including trying to let go, and fall into a wonderful wakefulness that's always here, that's always supporting us, because it's what we are.
Mm. Okay, so here's the parsing of enlightenment. For people, the audience that we have, community that we have here on Be Here Now Network and in this particular podcast, Mind Rolling, I like to get as practical as I can. And I guess, for instance, people talk about getting enlightened.
Uh-huh.
What can I do to get enlightened, right? And I give the best example I give is Ram Das himself. When he was in India with Neem Karoli Baba, who we called Maharaji, he asked that very question. And he wanted a practice
uh-huh.
that would get him enlightened. Mm-hmm. So he asked. And he had friends that were into Buddhism that were getting quote unquote secret teachings through mantra practice or whatever yeah. could be a ritualistic practice.
Yeah.
So that's what he was looking for. Mm-hmm. And Maharaji said to him, feed people.
Ah.
And got him pissed off.
Uh-huh.
You know, I've told the story many times because it's so clear as to how we in the West expect mm-hmm. this, the idea of enlightenment is the way that we chase, you know, our next career or a university degree or something like that. And then, so Ram Das, well, this is BS. I mean, you know, my mm-hmm. friends, my Buddhist friends are getting the real thing. What is this? And he asked again in a different way, how do I raise Kundalini? And Maharaji said, love everyone. So at that point, Ram Dass let go and understood that, you know, the level at which he was asking this question was coming from an egoic, shall we say, place.
Yeah.
And it was useless. And the reality is, I like to say to people, enlightenment, that's way beyond our pay grade. How about, and you did include this, how about that we become much more aware? How about that we become kinder, more compassionate, more loving? That to me is enlightenment in terms of our day-to-day lives and the way that we interact with people. And a term like enlightenment is can be really unfortunate if we are pursuing that in the way that we pursue everything in our lives. From
so true, that's so true, Raghu. And you know, we have I gave a talk at Zen Center recently in which I talked about the different kinds of yogas from the Vedas and the Upanishadic tradition, and how they're all present in Zen. Karma yoga, service, is what the Bodhisattva is all about. I mean, we really emphasize the Bodhisattva in Mahayana Zen, and that's, from my point of view, karma yoga.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How did Roshi explicate that in particular to his students? I've never really heard.
No, I don't think he explicated it very well. I mean, no, not very well. I don't want to put him down. I don't think he explicated it much, but he would always say, well, with me, well, what does your wife think? Have you listened to her? What does your father think? Have you listened to him? And I said, and then, you know, he would do that about many, many different people. So when I moved up to San Francisco and I dropped out of Stanford, he helped me find a place to stay right across the street from where his temple was. And then he said, and what does your father think? I said, oh, my father is very materialistic. Mm. He said, material is good. So, I can give many examples of how once we went to an art exhibit at the San Francisco Art Institute, and we wanted to go there because they had some exhibit that I knew he'd be interested in, and a few of us went in a car with him, and he didn't watch the show. There was a good speaker talking about the whole thing. He just got up and left. And then afterwards, I said, Sensei, you missed the show. What were you doing? He said, I was buying a card for Ruth. Now, Ruth was my roommate. She was very depressed. And so more important for him was to buy a card for Ruth, which he then brought back to her. She had wanted to go, but she was feeling too hopeless. So he did those. He never talked much about it. He just did these.
He acted. Yeah. Mm. Wow. One of the things, you know, I mean, quite a number of things struck me in the book, Tim. It's got a lot of, really great material to contemplate on. And certainly, I know this is something that I used to talk to Ram Dass about a lot. And actually, we have this movie, Becoming Nobody, that we put together a few years ago.
Oh, that sounds like a Zen book.
Eh?
Sounds like a Zen book, Becoming Nobody.
Becoming Nobody, yeah. Oh, yeah, no, it's really great. It really is a compendium of, you know, talking about his direct experiences.
Oh, I don't
over, know. Over his... Yeah, everybody, you can get it anywhere. You can rent it on Amazon and Apple and all that stuff.
It's a video?
It's a film. It's a documentary film.
Nice.
And it's how, you know, he his thing about becoming nobody, and it takes it through different stages. And of course, he does absolutely say you have to be a somebody before you can. You can't just be a become a nobody.
Very important. You may remember this from my book. I talk quite a bit in my book about spiritual bypass.
Yeah, I want to talk about that too.
I'm also a psychologist, and it just hurts me to see how often people spiritually bypass.
I'm quite with you, and I do want to talk. But you know what I want to talk about first, which is he talks about in the film too, is masks. That's why when I read this, I went, oh yeah, we've done a lot of talking about that. And just from your book, you also met someone named Tu Lun, right? Zen person.
He was a teacher, but came later very famous too. He founded City of 10,000 Buddhas in Northern California.
Oh, really? Wow. I've never heard of him.
It's a huge, I don't know, bunch of Chinese Americans must have given a lot of money, but in those days, nobody knew him. He was just in a little apartment about two blocks from Suzuki Roshi. You
know. What town was that in?
City of 10,000 Buddhas. Maybe you.
No. Where are these two incredible
people? In San Francisco.
Oh, it was in San Francisco.
In Japan town.
Really?
Poor Tu Lun couldn't talk to anyone. He went to Chinatown. He only spoke Mandarin, and they spoke Cantonese.
You didn't talk to them either.
No.
Wow. So he had a translator. So anyhow, you say how these two beings opened your eyes to a new world, which is how I started this thing. How did you get opened up to this new world? And I love this, Tim. Theirs was a world without masks, a world of openness, spontaneity, unpredictability, and ease. It's like a cool breeze, right? And I well know exactly what you're saying, being around Neem Karoli Baba when I was, and probably around I was in my early 20s at the time, and to have that breeze waft through you.
And of course, that breeze is always blowing. We have to have some trust in that. It's always blowing, so that we can do whatever we need to prepare for this wonderful accident.
But what you do say, I also recognize that the key to their natural ease was freedom from yearning.
That's
right. Or I would say freedom from grasping.
Yeah, which is a paradox. Yes.
Yeah. You were stuck in a catch-22. Talk about that catch-22.
That's
a common experience.
Yeah, well, as you well know, that catch-22 is the more I want it, the more solidified it becomes. My neural pathways harden because I want it. And it's only when my neural pathways open that it happens. And the aspiration is so important. If without the aspiration, I wouldn't have had this wonderful, wonderful life. But as soon as the aspiration hardens into expectation, then we're in trouble. Then we need a teacher to kind of give us a little poke or something, or somebody, because
a whack on the back with one of those big sticks in the zendo.
And I'm sure that that happened with Ram Dass's teacher because I see that happening all over the place. And I remember how, and also you have to ready yourself so that when you do completely die to yourself, you're able to come back and have a narrator and not be freaked out. That's another part that people took psychedelics back then, but they just wasted them. They wasted them.
Well, I don't think it's a waste. Even if people were wasting, there was still something, you know, when you have that ineffable thing happen and that complete interconnectivity experience.
Yes, and I had that too, but I had friends who ended up in the psych wards.
Yeah. And you and me both, and they were not, for the most part, they were not doing what both Leary and Alpert suggested, which is set
right.
and setting and,
right.
and treating it as a sacred journey.
That's right.
You know, going to the disco or whatever it was back then and taking
that's
a hit.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, you're going to end up potentially in trouble for sure.
Yeah, yeah.
So, but I to get you know to the true face where the mask is no longer there takes a lot of courage because it's about and as you say letting go of judgment and being less reactive and less anxious, pretentious, more calm and open and authentic, and then suddenly. That mask, which is basically to me equates to the completely self-interested person that we people that we are on a day-to-day basis. If we, you know, as we wake up in the morning, and my friend Krishnadas called it, it's the movie of me. And
that's you know, a good one.
You wake up in the morning, you're the protagonist, and you're the director, you're the writer. You're, in fact, you even write all the reviews of your
that's
day,
right?
Right? And
that's
right.
Nice.
So, yeah, that is our mask, and we're comfortable with it. And letting go of, as you suggested here, particularly around, you know, judgment and pretentiousness and not being authentic because we're defending and protecting.
And trying to be spiritual, the mask of I'm spiritual. Now I got ordained as a priest. I'm bald and I'm going to just do that. And I'm rejecting everything else, whether it's a Buddhist priest or a Catholic priest or a Vedanta priest, it's a new mask.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
exactly.
I'm saying that although I've been a priest my whole life, you know, so.
These things don't just fly away, you know, even once we start practice and realize there has to be something that
right.
we can integrate into our lives that is provides a fulcrum for not getting as deeply caught and reactive and judgmental and so on.
Yes.
But nothing goes away. Ram Dass used to talk about, you know, he's say it in a funny way. I've, you know, as a psychologist, I've quite well identified my neurotic tendencies and habitual patterns. And let me tell you, not one of them has disappeared in all of these decades, except one thing that's happened. And this is my own experience. They've become... He called them little schmooze, right? Which is a bit of a Yiddish thing. S-H-M-O-O-S, schmooze.
Okay.
They're little guys. They don't quite envelop you and grab you and by the throat. You know, they become something where there's spaciousness around them, around these neurotic tendencies and so on.
That's right. And as you referred to before, that's what Suzuki Roshi called, just watch the movie. And when I said, well, they're the good movies in North Beach, and then there's these awful movies that you watch. And he said, I like them all. Just watch the movie.
What was he watching?
Well, in Japantown, he had come over to the United States to minister to the Japanese congregation. They paid his salary and they gave him the place to live, but they didn't sit in meditation. They did ritual, they did weddings, they did funerals.
Yeah.
Just like actually my in-laws in India, you know, my daughter, they didn't do the meditation. And he found he did the meditation by himself till a few of us started sitting with him, but every Saturday night he would go to the movies that the Japanese congregation had. It was a shoot 'em up class C samurai movie in the same building that we did our meditation. And I would never go to any of those. I went over to North Beach where they had the classy movies, the the artistic movies.
What, of the samurai movies? I mean, I used to go to them all the time down there myself.
Oh, yeah? Well, yeah. I didn't go to them. They looked like just bloods and guts to me, and it didn't turn... I thought it wouldn't support my practice. You know, I was kind of narrow in my perspective. Anyway, I noticed him bleary-eyed on a Sunday morning when he'd have to give a talk. And I said to him once, well, you go to those movies every Saturday night, and then you get up and sit in meditation with us. He said, yes. And I said, do you like any of them? And he said, I like them all. I like them all. So whatever movie's passing through, I like it all.
Right.
I like them all.
That's the consciousness. That's the enlightenment we're talking about, I guess, is just non-judgmental whatsoever. And he was there. He was serving the people that wanted him to be there. Yeah. Amazing. Oh, let's talk about idiot compassion, one of my favorite subjects. Which that term comes from Trungpa Rinpoche Trogyam.
I know.
And did you meet up with him anytime?
I studied at Naropa in the late 70s, 79 and 80, I think. And he was there. I never had a one-to-one with him, but I did hear him speak. You know.
Yeah. Amazing, right? I mean, even with all of the crazy wisdom stuff, which is, in my mind, beyond my pay grade, I wouldn't have any idea. I did meet up with him in various places.
Did you have a one-to-one meeting with him?
Not one-to-one. It was more because I was with Ram Dass at the time. So there was a few of us with Ram Dass, and we would meet.
Sure. I wonder when that was. That was 79 and 80 for me. When was that for you?
Well, we came back from India in 72, Ram Dass and I and others. And so in 72-3 is when we were seeing him at Tale of the Tiger, which is now called Karma something else.
Oh, you were
Karma Choling.
Very early.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah. Yeah. And he was extraordinary. So yeah, idiot compassion. Mm-hmm. I guess this guy,
John Wellwood.
John Wellwood. That was more about spiritual bypass, but I want to talk about idiot compassion. Mm-hmm. And, how do you define it?
Well, there's this movement within 12 steps, and there are specific groups now for codependency. And codependency is that if you're anxious, I'm anxious, and I need to take care of you so that you won't be anxious to not feel anxious myself. And if you're angry, I empathize with your anger, but not in a healthy way. I'm caught by your anger, and I have to get rid of your anger, help you out of that anger, or I don't feel okay. And that's idiot compassion. And that they have now all over the Twin Cities. That's where I live. Yeah. There are several codependency groups. It's not alcohol, it's not drugs, it's not sex, although they have all those. It's not gambling, it's just base codependency. And those, as a psychologist, I've worked with a lot of people who never developed healthy ego boundaries. And so they come into Zen and they're just they just feel everybody's pain and they're caught by it. And they have no freedom themselves. Hmm. So that's how I talk about idiot compassion.
Yeah. I guess back, I remember, you know, him talking about Trump talking about it. And it's pretty much what you said, but it was also the completely, really ridiculous way that we think we are going to be helping someone and actually we are doing the exact opposite because our motivations are not pure. They're just not. And so we're doing things that actually exacerbate whatever that situation that person may be.
Right. We're compensating for our own fundamental insecurity. We're trying to, and we don't realize it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, as you say here, it's a common response. When we just can't bear situations, we ourselves find uncomfortable. Perfect in its explanation there. And we'd rather project suffering onto others than recognize and deal with our own discomfort. I mean, well said, Tim. You know, and then you end up drained and exhausted from helping people. Yeah. Then if you are, you're engaging in some form of idiot compassion.
Yeah. I used to be a social worker before I was a psychologist. And so many of my friends just got burned out. And they just, after 3 or 4 years, they just left. They couldn't do it anymore. Mm. Luckily, I had a meditation practice.
Mm. Right. What would you give, you know, so if people listening to this say to themselves, yes, we have all been in this situation. Nobody is clear from this situation because we can't see the reality of what is necessary because we are still so very caught in our own mini-me land, I call it. What do you say to somebody who kind of, they hear this and they realize, shit, I've been there too. And what is the antidote?
What is the antidote to someone who's caught by that and sees it? Well, I don't know exactly what the antidote is, but
it's take a pill. This is we're in America. If something's wrong, you take a pill.
What I ask
the question's a bit dumb.
What I ask them is, that person made you angry, and that is an anger. I mean, your compassion for that person, for their anger, made you angry. How are you doing now? And if they say, I'm still a little angry, then I say, well, do you think that really helps them? Let's just sit in meditation for a few minutes and see if you're ready to let go of that. Because do you really think that helps them? Mm. So I do this usually one-to-one with people.
Mm. Right. Right.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, absolutely.
I work a lot one-to-one with people.
Oh, you do, huh?
I'm not a therapist anymore, but I'm kind of a therapist.
Yeah, more a spiritual therapist. I know I have friends who were therapists, and now, you know, they got to a stage where they didn't need to or no longer were retired from that, but then kept working with people who had some basic understanding of, there is a way for us to turn this around. And I guess this answers that question, which is called, with a big P, practice. Mm-hmm. Unless we are doing something to, open us up to places where we can transform through understanding and deep listening to ourselves. Becomes very tough, right?
Right, and I have 5 chapters in my book on different ways to practice, all of which complement each other, and you can just do one or do all 5.
Mm. Yes, no, that's great. Let's talk about, since we were talking about idiot compassion, and I talk about spiritual bypass a lot with different people on the podcast. So we were there with John Wellwood. I didn't know that, a Buddhist psychologist I've not heard of. He coined that term.
Yeah, right? He passed away now, but he was my teacher at Naropa in something like 79. And I took a class in Buddhist psychology from him. He was a student of Trungpa's, and he talked about, I'd never heard of it before, spiritual bypassing. I think he coined the term.
Hmm. So here, a little bit of a definition. We are imprisoned by the constraints of a spiritual superego. You know, we're all gung-ho when we realize, wait a minute, there is a path and I'm getting on this path. You know, especially difficult for us in the West in particular, because there's such, you know, the competitive stuff and and the conditioning on that level is very, very strong. Making spiritual teachings into prescriptions about what we should do, how we should think, how we should speak, or how we should feel. And you say the only shoulds are, that are healthy are those that support our authenticity. Our authenticity, which is difficult because we are unfortunately have a lot of delusion. And very difficult to just settle into, you know, into that being that Suzuki Roshi so effortlessly displayed to you when he opened the door. I just have that thing. He opened the door and then boom. That's very fortunate. There's a quote from another person. You've introduced a few people I've never heard of. Jack Elias. And he wrote Zen and the Art of Spiritual Bypassing. Is that true?
Yes.
Wow, that sounds, I mean, I love the quote. Talk about an antidote. Approach the sacred place with full self-respect, respect for your own sacredness, and demand to be let in. No slicing or dicing or fawning required. No arrogance either. Just genuine commitment to your own basic goodness, which is one of the foremost tenets of Buddhism. It's funny because we have in the tradition that we are in, Neem Karoli Baba, you know, introduced us to Indian devotees in the very beginning. Ram Dass was actually told to go live after he met him that first time with an Indian family not far away, you know.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And that person, whose name is K.K. Sah, it was his family, and he became a mentor to us when we went over as well. And part of the deal was that then we had no understanding of Indian family, and thank God we got trained up there as well, which was, it's just what he's saying. You don't ask politely for anything, putting on this guise of Mr. Nice Guy and I'm a visitor and I'm going to be. If you don't demand from them the cup of tea, can I have a cup of tea? That kind of thing. You know, they want you, and we couldn't understand this. They want you to demand it so they feel like you are part of the family. And they say to us, would you ask your mother for a cup of tea? And I think this translates perfectly to how with the teachings, with the teachers that we...
That's right. Ramakrishna has a saying, which may not be in my book, maybe it probably isn't. A hungry person always finds food. So a hungry person is not caught by etiquette.
Right.
Not caught by shoulds and should nots.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So that's a good teaching. Absolutely. Boy, time is flying, Tim.
Do you edit this or is this?
No editing. We don't do editing.
Is this
We're not
live?
Gonna edit even this. No, it's live, but I don't edit. Who's gonna edit? There's something, there's so much stuff here, Tim. We could basically go on for more than an hour, but just in the last few minutes, generosity. So we've talked about how, you know, my friend Christian has talked about the movie of me, and I am doing an audio book with my friend Duncan Trussell. People who listen to this podcast know that, and I've said it many times, and it's from the movie of me to the movie of we is the basic concept. We don't even have a final title. Yeah.
Right.
So one of the things that I included, or we will include, is a concept that I that was really well said by Ram Dass around generosity, that generosity is a fulcrum to be able to transform this addiction to self-interest, basically. And you have it here. The Buddha said, if bodhisattvas act generously beyond any concept of generosity, their merit will be incalculable. And putting the needs of others above our own. And when we commit to a spiritual practice, it's tempting to fixate on this idea of supporting others at the expense of ourselves. But this dualistic view of generosity is not only a thought distortion, but also a detriment to your mental, emotional, and physical well-being, and therefore unsustainable. This kind of either-or thinking guarantees you no peace. And here's the beauty here. Authentic generosity is not about trying to be good or to live up to some ideal. Instead, if we're feeling like we're stingy, not wanting to extend ourselves to a particular person or share with them, an actional understanding of generosity includes opening up to and being generous to this feeling. That's the greatest thing in this book, the way you said that, Tim. I mean, there's so many great things. But that really hit me. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, sure. So as a psychologist, well, also I'm teaching Buddhism and brain science right now.
But as a
psychologist, I talk about the amygdala. We all have an amygdala, and that's fight, flight, freeze. Fight, flight, flip, freeze. And that governs so much of our behavior, even if we're advanced meditators, even if we've died to our small selves. And so if that, when we're scared, when we're stingy, we're usually scared.
Yeah.
And that's because our amygdala has fired up and it wants to protect us, because all species want to preserve themselves. They want to have offspring. And so, but we have a possibility to be generous to our stinginess just by opening up to it and noticing it, recognizing it, accepting it, feeling it in our bodies, and then it passes. The amygdala quiets down. The amygdala just stops. There's a lot of research only in the 21st century about decrease in the size of the amygdala among very experienced meditators. It's really cool stuff. Yeah.
Wow. Wow, that's amazing. Wow. And then healing, you say, begins with embracing our flaws.
That's and right.
That's to even get to the point where you can be natural and authentically generous with anybody, you have to start there. Compassion begins with embracing the flaws of others, but
right.
Healing begins with embracing our own. What is, talk about just briefly, wabi-sabi, because teaches us to embrace rather than resist. What is that practice?
Oh, wabi-sabi comes from Japanese art. And
Right.
I don't know, do I explain it in the book? I can't even remember.
I don't
talk about it unless I explain it in the book. Then it's better for you to read it or me to read
it. No, you do explain it. It's got three primary features: imperfection and irregularity, age, and simplicity and naturalness.
Good. Okay. Now,
you did do it.
I'm going to tell a story about wabi-sabi.
Okay, great.
Japanese art is really affected by Zen historically. Mm. And there's something called Raku Pari, R-A-K-U, that really embodies that. And Raku Pari, you bake in the cracks, you bake in the overflows, you bake in the irregularities, and those cups, those teacups are really valued because each is idiosyncratic, each is individual, and yet each is authentic because it's open to its cracks, it's open to its irregularities. So I wanted to go to, this is probably in the book, I wanted to go to Japan to practice Zen because I thought there was more sitting there, and I really meditate. And Suzuki knew that I was looking at many different options and kind of comparing and contrasting and sort of tripping out on my different options. And we were having breakfast one morning, and he pointed to the wall, which was full of Raku pottery cups. And he said, "If I try to choose the best cup, I will never appreciate any of them." So, authenticity, wabi-sabi, just being who we are and what we are, flaws and irregularities and all.
Beautiful. As you described it, I do remember knowing about it. I mean, I just couldn't recall how what it really meant. And
the Japanese have done a really good job aesthetically. Now, they don't sit in meditation. I don't know if they ever did, but they've done a good job aesthetically at kind of manifesting what I call non-dual feeling.
I haven't spent time there really, so that's a little bit of a bucket list to be able to go and spend some time. Yeah.
Well, I never spent time there either.
Oh, you didn't?
No, only India and Bhutan.
That's great. Well, it's been a pleasure hanging out with you here, and everybody, this book is chocked full of antidotes to the movie of me, basically. Here it is, along with my notes. And we're going to give you a link, everybody. It'll be in the show notes so that you can connect. Tim has a couple of other books as well, and you can connect up with them. Suzuki Roshi, Zen Mind, No Mind. Is that the name of that book?
His book, his most famous book is Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind.
Beginner's Mind. Yes. Yeah, which was de rigueur reading back when when things were opening up for both of us at that time. So that'll all be in the show notes. And just happy to have you here.
Thank you so much, Raghu. I'm so happy to have that you included me and shared some of your wisdom too, because wisdom is not owned by anyone. It's just out there.
Absolutely. That's the wonderful thing about our interconnectivity and the reality of it. So, thank you again, Tim. And this is Mind Rolling on Be Here Now Network. Go to BeHereNowNetwork.com and take advantage of the plethora of wonderful teachers. One of them, Tim, of course, Alan Watts is on our network. You know,
is he
the OG guy? Yeah, and Ram Dass, of course, and Jack Kornfield, many.
Alan Watts came to Stanford, then Ram Dass came to Stanford. I was kind of in the right place at the right time.
Yeah, to say the least, yeah. Oh, wow, Alan, amazing being, absolutely. All right, we shall see you next time. Thank you, Tim.
You're very welcome. Now, you think it was okay without the mic, or can you not really tell yet?
Oh, don't worry. It's all going to be good. No worry.
Okay. All right. Alrighty.
Hang in there for a second, though.